Good evening. Welcome to the Conversazioni of the 13th Annual Living Education Retreat. We've been doing these conversazionis for a few years now, and they are modeled after the fashion of the conversazionis that we see in the Charlotte Mason Digital Archives, talked about in the parents' reviews. So, of course, conversazioni is an Italian word, which describes a scholarly or a formal gathering where something related to literature or the arts is discussed. They were a great way for Mason's Parents National Education Union to form community and invite the public so that their organization could continue to grow. All right, so our theme this year is parent craft. And parent craft can be defined as the skills and knowledge used by parents in raising children. So it's a nice, broad definition, and we're going to zero in on one particular and important virtue that all parents need when it comes to parenting. But I am certain that every single workshop or immersion that you attend this weekend is going to help you in regards to parent craft. So it's a nice word, and it really struck me the first time I read it. So it came into being at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. If you search parent craft now, you'll find it's mostly only associated with like childbirth classes or something like that. But I had not heard it before. So I came across this term in a library discard book I picked up at a sale. The book is called Friends of the Family, The English Home and Its Guardians, 1850 to 1940. So reading about the emergence of family policy in England during Charlotte Mason's time, how the Victorians elevated domesticity, how politics came into play, who were the experts, who was arguing, who were the main players during this time? All in the historical context of when Mason was around is fascinating to me. It's not a page-turner. It's a scholarly book, but it was really interesting to me. So I'm reading along in this book, and I come to the chapter titled Mental Science and the Happy Family. And there is a section dedicated to the Parents National Education Union, right? So this is one of those times when we do a little squeal because we find Charlotte Mason out in the wild, right? Where we're not expecting her, and there she is. And it's not just a mention. It's 14 glorious pages, right? So I was so excited. I'm starting to read through that, and I'm going to share with you some of the highlights from that section in the book. First off, the section, which is going to focus on Charlotte Mason, is prefaced with this. But largely hidden from history has been the work of well-read amateurs whose aim was to keep parents at the center of primary education. So he's describing Charlotte Mason and her people as well-read amateurs. I thought, well, that's interesting, okay. So he goes on, Mr. Belmer, to describe her upbringing and her becoming an orphan at 16. And then her path to the expansion of the use of the PNEU syllabi across England. Along the way, he does a brilliant discussion of Dr. Maria Montessori and the strong objections that the PNEU and Charlotte had to her philosophy. And he describes her as a, Charlotte Mason, as a formidable headmistress. He even mentions the whole Lady Isabella Margison takeover attempt, and he's stating that she treated London's Belgravia branch as a fiefdom. So there's lots of great stuff in this book, and as the reader reads through it, and you come away from it, you go, wow, these well-read amateurs really changed the educational landscape in England, and changed the view of the child, really. And then you think, according to his description, this homeless orphan, I mean, she had some incredible courage. Look what she did. So I just found it really, really interesting. I recommend it for the historical context especially for the medical physiological part. There were just names I hadn't read before and some that I were familiar with, but it's where I first read the term parentcraft. Okay, so I want to tell you a story that is a true story that really happened to my family about 20 years ago. So Kent and I were asleep up in our bedroom in our three-story Victorian home. The time he was a police officer in our small hometown of Windom, Minnesota. It was about 1 a.m. in the morning. Our bedroom was on the second floor at the top of a flight of stairs. Two of the little boys were across the hall in their bedrooms, and I had a baby daughter, Katie, who was in our bedroom but in the back in a crib. Well, I woke with a start, and I'm a light sleeper anyway. I was listening for the baby, right, and the children, and I thought I heard a loud noise downstairs. But in my grogginess, I wasn't sure. Then I heard a very distinct sound of our creaky wood floors and somebody walking across them. So I quickly gave Kent a shove, and the adrenaline is starting to rush through my body as I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and I say, "Somebody's in our house." And then what happened next was kind of a blur. I rolled off the bed onto the floor, and I sat there trying to make a decision as I heard the person continue up the stairs and start yelling my husband's name. I watched Kent stand up, calmly but quickly, and step outside of the room. And I'm sitting there trying to think of 1,000 things at once. Do I go grab the baby? Do I go the back way and go tell the boys not to make a sound? Does the man have a gun? I have no idea. So, like I said, as I'm trying to process all this, Kent stands up, steps out into the hallway, confronts the man with a really firm hand, escorts him back down the steps and safely away from the sleeping family. I heard him reasoning with the drunken man. And the next thing I knew, before I had taken any action, there were police officers all in our downstairs. So this man went to jail for burglary. The children never knew what transpired. I carried some negative effects of that traumatic incident for a while, and you better believe we now double lock our doors to our house. Although we still leave the keys in the car in Windom, so, yeah. But what Kent displayed that night was courage. And courage is what I want to talk to you about this evening. So this isn't a word I hear a whole lot with parenting, and why we don't, I don't know. Usually I hear it with some new men's Bible study, or you'll hear it, story of David and Goliath, things like that. But I want to talk about how courage, what it really is, and why it is so important for everyone, particularly parents. I was thinking and meditating a lot on these words from Charlotte Mason. She says, "It is only as we recognize our limitations that our work becomes effective. When we see definitely what we are to do, what we can do, and what we cannot do, we set to work with confidence and courage." And I really want to focus on that ending. We set to work with confidence and courage. So let's begin by defining this word, courage. In Latin, cor was the heart, and agere meant to lead. Thus, courage meant quite literally to lead with your heart. Mason tells us in her volumes that this word comes to us from when Norman French was the language of the court and when chivalry was the law of noble living. The Normans, too, perceived that courage was of the heart, and she tells us that courage dwells somewhere in each of us and places courage in volume 4, ourselves. She puts it squarely in the house of heart, part of her mantle metaphor for our inner life. So Charlotte tells us about 10 different forms of courage, 10 different types that are in us already if we but pay attention and listen. And we're going to briefly go through these tonight, but I hope that you will give each of them more consideration when you have time. So I'm going to share Charlotte's words from volume 4, beginning on page 112. I'm going to share the first 5 forms, and then you're going to narrate in small groups. And then I'm going to share the last 5 forms, and you're going to narrate once again in small groups, okay? So are you all ready to pay attention? All right, the first form of courage that she addresses is the courage of attack. Charlotte says, "The sheep has the courage of attack for the sake of her lamb. The bird will sit on her eggs in the face of that monster, man. A blue tit once thought proper to nest in a letterbox. Of course, people went to see the sight. And the courage with which the little creature hissed at the gigantic intruders was very curious and admirable. The toddling child has courage to protect his pets. Many a tender mother has had the courage of an awful death to save her baby." So I would put Kent's reaction to the man who entered our home in this category. Charlotte says, if we would but believe it, we have all courage to face any calamity, any enemy, any death, but courage is attended by his demons, fear, cowardice, and nervousness. So that's the fear of attack, or the courage of attack, excuse me. Next is the courage of endurance. She says, fear with his kin, panic and anxiety is on the watch for those moments when courage sleeps, lulled by security. When we consider the splendid valor that men of all sorts show in battle, we begin to see how universal courage is. In our country, it is those who choose that enlist in the army. But the courage shown by men drawn by conscription is not less than that of our own army. Also, how possible it is for every man to be gripped by shameful fear and to act upon the panic born of fear is shown by the fact that a whole company, heretofore held as brave as the rest, has been known more than once to turn tail and fly before the enemy. So next is the courage of serenity. Few of us are likely to be tried in a field of battle, but the battlefield has an advantage over the 1,000 battles we have to fight in our lives, because the sympathy of numbers carries those men forward. The form of courage which meets pain and misfortune with calm endurance is needed by us all. No one escapes the call for fortitude, if it be only in the dentist chair. It is well to be sure of ourselves. That, Dave, that was nothing personal. Okay. Okay. It is well to be sure of ourselves, to know for certain that we have courage for everything that may come. Not because we are more plucky than others, but because all persons are born with it. There she says that again. Assured of our courage, we must not let this courage sleep and allow ourselves to be betrayed into panic by an accident or a wasp or a rat. It is unseemly, unbecoming for any of us, even the youngest, to lose our presence of mind when we are hurt or in danger. We not only lose the chance of being of use to others, but we make ourselves a burden and a spectacle. Anxious fuss in the small emergencies of life, such as traveling, household mischances, pressure of work is a form of panic fear, the fear that all might not go well, or that something may be forgotten and left undone. Let us possess ourselves and say, what does it matter? All undue concern about things and arrangements is unworthy of us. It is only persons that matter, and the best thing we can do is to see that one person keeps a serene mind in unusual or fretting circumstances, then we shall be sure that one person is ready to be of use. And that reminds me of the British keep calm and carry on, right? All right, so that's the courage of serenity, the courage of our affairs. The form of fear that is inclined to fret and worry and become agitated under any slight stress of circumstances darkens into anxiety in the face of some success we are striving after, some calamity that we fear. Anxiety obtains more sympathy than other forms of fear because the person who is anxious suffers much, and the cause for anxiety is often sadly real. But we do ourselves injustice by being anxious. We have been sent into life fortified, some more so, some less, with a courage which should enable us to take the present without any fearful looking forward. And indeed, we do so, the feeblest of us, when we are kept fully employed by immediate things. That is how mothers and wives can go through months of the nursing of their nearest and dearest with cheerful countenance. They tell you they dare not look forward and that they live from hour to hour, and so they are able to bring happiness and even gaiety into the sick room, though a sorrowful end is before them. If this noble courage is possible in the face of coming grief, it is also possible, if we would believe it, in the face of lesser matters, coming examinations, coming losses, coming distresses of every kind, even the worst distress, when those dear to us fail us and fall away from godly living. Let not your heart be anxious is the command of Christ. The command presupposes the power of obedience, and it is for this that heavy things are spoken of the fearful and the unbelieving. Tolkien in his writings talks about courage so wonderfully, so many times. At the beginning of The Hobbit, you have Bilbo lost in the tunnels, totally alone, and he says, "Go back," he thought, "no good at all. Go sideways, impossible. Go forward, only thing to do. On we go." So up he got and trotted along with his little sword held in front of him and one hand feeling the wall and his heart all a patter and a pitter. And so the fifth one for this section is the courage of our opinions. Boy, she talks about opinions a lot and in a lot of different places, doesn't she? By opinions, I do not mean the loosely taken up catchwords of the moment, those things which everybody says, and with which it is rather agreeable than otherwise to startle our less advanced friends, but those few opinions founded upon knowledge and principle which we really possess. It is worthwhile to examine ourselves as to what opinions are as to the questions discussed in conversation or otherwise. We may find that we have no distinct opinion. If so, let us not take up with the first that offers, but think, inquire, read, consider both sides, and then be ready with a gentle, clear, well-grounded expression of opinion. When someone remarks, for example, "I think missionaries are a mistake. The religions people have are those best suited to their natures," or "It is no use thinking about the multitude. It is the few who have intellect or art who are worth caring for," and so on. We often allow other people's opinions to pass without protest because we believe that they have been carefully thought out. But it is surprising how a word of simple conviction will arrest people who express the most outrageous opinions. At any rate, this form of courage is due from us. All right. I would like everyone to turn and in groups of 2 to 4 and narrate those first 5. Try not to look at your notes, okay? Go for it. Oh. Yeah, you can. Well. Okay. So let's move on. That was only the first 5. The second 5 is going to go a little quicker, but there's 5 more that we're going to talk about. I could see you were having some good discussion. I wish I could have heard all of them, but. So let's move on. So number 6, continuing on with the different forms of courage. The courage of frankness. She says, "The courage of frankness is very charming. A certain degree of reticence is due to ourselves and to others. The person who pours out all his affairs indiscriminately is a bore. But on the other hand, he who shows undue caution, discretion, distrust, is of a fearful and unbelieving spirit and fails in the characters of the noble heart. Our motive is our best guide to the right mean in this matter. If we reserve our matters because we are unwilling to bore our friends with trivial things, it is well. But if we reserve them because we distrust the sympathy or the fairness, the kindness or the comprehension of the people we live amongst, we make a failure of courage. The courage of reproof. The courage of reproof is to be exercised with delicacy and gentleness, but there can be no faithful friendship between equals without this courage. The courage of confession. She says, to name one more form of courage, the courage of open, frank confession of that which we have done amiss or left undone in the small matters of daily life to the person concerned is very strengthening. But I am not sure that the habit of confessing feelings and thoughts always arises from courage. Acts and omissions are safer ground. We might have an interesting discussion about that. All right, 9, the courage of our capacity. Then there is what we may call the courage of our capacity, the courage which assures us that we can do the particular work which comes in our way and will not lend an ear to the craven fear which reminds us of failures in the past and unfitness in the present. It is an intellectual courage, too, which enables us to grapple with tasks of the mind with a sense of adequacy. Intellectual panic is responsible for many failures, for our failure to understand an argument, to follow an experiment, and very largely for our insular failure to speak and comprehend the vocables of foreign tongues. Intellectual panic is responsible, too, for the catchwords we pass as our opinions. We fear it is not in us to form an opinion worth the holding and worth the giving forth. And the last one is the courage of opportunity. She says, the courage of opportunity, of which Shakespeare says, there is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune, is also connected with the courage of capacity, and is to be distinguished from the gambling spirit of foolhardiness, which is ready to seek and try all hazards. One note of difference is perhaps that courage is ready for that which comes, while foolhardiness goes a-seeking. Courage waits for guidance. And then she quotes her poem, holding as creed that circumstance, a sacred oracle speaks with the voice of God to faithful souls. Which comes from her poem, Moses, A Study. All right, that's for the last 5. Get back in your groups and let's talk through those. Narrate them back. All right. Nice work, everybody. It takes courage to narrate, doesn't it? Huh?
Which one
was that? That's number 11, the courage to narrate. Okay. All right. So I wonder, since Charlotte wrote about those 10 forms of courage, was she pulling from her own life and experience? I mean, her life exhibits just about every one of those forms of courage, but really, so does my story, and really, so does yours. Let's look at one that wasn't mentioned. Brené Brown, she's done fascinating research on the human condition, on courage and vulnerability. And she says, it takes courage to say yes to rest and play in a culture where exhaustion is seen as a status symbol. And she's only echoing what Charlotte Mason said 100 years before. She says, if she would, speaking of the mother, applies to the father, if she would only have courage to let everything go when life becomes too tense, and just take a day or half a day out in the fields, or with a favorite book, or in a picture gallery looking long and well at just two or three pictures, or in bed without the children, life would go on far more happily. I'm sure you can think of some other forms of courage too. But right now, we're going to do a picture study. Now, the picture that I chose to do for our conversazione this evening, I chose it for three reasons, and those reasons will soon become very clear. So I need my friends to help pass out the pictures. I would like you to not look at them, and let's keep them face down as we pass them out, and don't turn them over until I ask. All right, the painting that we're going to look at tonight is by Raphael from Urbino, Italy, who lived from 1483 to 1520. Now, the actual size of this painting that you're going to look at is approximately the size of the print you have in your hand. It's 11 by 9 inches and was painted as a series of miniature panels, and it's oil on wood. So does everyone have a copy now? Raise your hand if you don't. Oh, we need one up here. And then we should be good. Do we need some more? I do have a few more. Okay. All right. So I'd like you to quietly turn them over and study the picture quietly to yourself for a few minutes. Okay. So what I'd like you to do now is turn the picture over so that you can no longer see it. And don't peek at it, and get back into your little groups and narrate everything you saw. Okay, so I want to know if there was somebody in your group that had a very interesting insight, volunteer them right now so they can stand up and share that. Who had somebody in their group? Okay, Aaron, what were you going to say?
So my interesting insight, fact or fiction, was that the horse is turning back and looking at us because the horse's chivalry is being shown in not looking at the pit that they're about to fall into if they miss and don't slay the dragon.
Okay. Who else? Kristen, did you have something interesting? According to Janine, you do have something interesting. So.
Come on,
come on.
We just moved to California from Pennsylvania, so colors are very big in grass, right? So I noticed that, like, on this side, you had, like, full greenery, and towards the front, it was, like, more of a pale, like almost like the desert where it's just not as lush and green. And then even on the left side, the trees, they almost wanted to be green, but there wasn't fullness where on the right side there was. So I just thought about it.
Okay. Solid. Interesting. Anything? One more. Yes, Cindy.
Just to point, thinking back, because you talked about it too, just maybe that left side from a spiritual kind of dimension, that sin brings death and destruction. On the other side, there's life with God, and that whole thing of spiritual warfare, fighting.
Good. Excellent. So this masterpiece is, of course, St. George and the Dragon. And the quick backstory is a 3rd century Roman soldier of Christian faith is what it's depicting. He saved the daughter of a pagan king by subduing a dragon with his lance. The princess then led the dragon to the city where the saint killed it with his sword, prompting the king and his subjects to convert to Christianity. And for those obsessive types like me, this is a very interesting book about the entire history of this painting, and it has a very storied history. So it's called The Dragon's Trail, the biography of Raphael's masterpiece by Joanna Pittman. So I hope you enjoy that. But back to why I chose this picture. First, obviously, it's an excellent example of courage, right? And you could say there's a couple different forms of courage being exhibited, physical, maybe moral, maybe mental courage. So the second reason that I chose to do this picture is because we have Charlotte Mason encouraging us to consider the story behind it. In the preface to the Riverbend Press student edition of Ourselves, volume part one, Charlotte has some very specific encouraging words to the reader. She's reminiscing about what it was like to be a teenager, and she shares these words. She says, "We are poor things. We have great possibilities, and we are dreadfully in need of guidance. This little book," speaking of ourselves, "this little book is offered to the reader in the hope that it will help him to liberate the beautiful self, which is himself, and also to see that everyone has a beautiful self waiting to be let out. Saint George and the Dragon is a fable which each of us is called to enact." I thought that was really interesting. That's another reason. So we have, it's a masterpiece by Raphael. It showcases courage. Mason talks about the importance of the story. And there's one more reason why I shared this picture with you today. Okay, so over a year ago, I'm digging through the archives, right? And often in the parents' reviews, we see book reviews, right? In the 1912 Parents' Review, I see a review for a book called The Golden Key by Lillian Street. Okay, so the review states that this is a book intended for children founded on the model of The Cloud of Witness. So I'm thinking, hold everything, there's a cloud of witness for children. Okay, so just to catch everyone up who might not know what the cloud of witness is. So at the 10th LER, I unveiled our new reprinting of The Cloud of Witness, which is the book that Charlotte Mason gave to her college graduates in order that they might stay connected through meditative and spiritual thoughts. It follows the Christian year. We're in our third printing. Lots of people are reading it. Hundreds of us are reading it together. There's some in the back for sale. So I keep reading the review that I'm about this Golden Key. And it says, "Daily readings in prose and verse adapted to the seasons of the Christian year. The extracts come under such headings as watchfulness, humility, fear, gratitude. Some of these are beautiful and some are touching in their simplicity." So I am always getting asked for, do you have any recommendations for children's devotionals or to read along with their Bible or things like this? The Cloud of Witness is very much for adults, maybe for older high schoolers, maybe graduates. But I was thinking, what a great resource something like this could be for parents who wish to give their children the same type of readings as The Cloud of Witness. So I go look it up online, and there is literally one copy anywhere. Bookfinder is where I ended up. And of course, it's in England, and so I took a chance, and it wasn't that much, and I ordered it, and it came. And about a month later, it arrives, and I am sure I am not the only person here who occasionally cries over book mail. Right? But I did. I couldn't believe my eyes. So there's a picture of it. And it's beautiful, and there's the title page. So it's the same format as The Cloud. It has more stories, but fewer readings per page. The font is larger. I don't know why they don't do that with this one. The font is larger. It begins with scripture, and it follows a weekly theme. It has our favorite poets, Longfellow, Rossetti, Tennyson. There are huge excerpts from Mrs. Gaddy's Parables from Nature. There's excerpts from Water Babies by Kingsley. And much of it is taken from a book called Lyra Innocentium by John Keble, which is thoughts on Christian children, their ways and their privileges, and it's poetry for children, and much, much more. And I have to read to you The introduction by Willoughby Carter. This is beautiful. Listen to this. To see the beauty of child life is a distinctly Christian thing. Paganism ignored childhood. In all the Greek and Roman classics, references to the joy and gladness of child life are few and scanty. Childhood was a necessary evil to be got over as speedily as possible. Only the man and the woman counted. How great is the change brought about by Christianity? The starlights from Bethlehem have fallen across the centuries. Childhood is transfigured. The divine and human infant has kindled the imagination of men. Infancy and childhood now stand out, compelling supreme attention. Notably is this so in the modern world. Interest in the child life of the nation is universally acknowledged. If manhood is to be regenerated, it is with the child a beginning must be made. Miss Lillian Street has happily supplied a want. The golden key gives helpful thoughts to the child mind. Each day has its own message, prose and poetry. Story and parable fix the special truth. The scriptures of truth shed their glory over all. It's by Willoughby Carter. So I am working very, very hard on getting this reprinted through Riverbend Press. I know, it's so exciting. Yes. So I wrote a new introduction, and here's a bit of what I said. Whether you are a student wanting daily readings in the right key, or an adult who wants to return to the golden thoughts of childhood, the golden key is full of ideas that point us to the truth and remind us that Christ is always nearby, our help, companion, and savior, in whatever age or place we find ourselves. So if you are interested in pre-ordering one of these at a special LER rate of $25, I have sign-ups, and as soon as they're ready, hopefully by August 1st, I will send you a code, and you can order it for that price. Otherwise, it's going to be $30 at Riverbend Press. So, all right, so you might ask, this is great. What does this have to do with the picture study? So I wanted this book to have a color reprint in the front, just like the Cloud of Witness has the Light of the World. And this picture kept coming to my mind, and that is why I chose it for so many reasons. Mason mentions it talks about courage, and what better picture to maybe be having thoughts of God by sitting and meditating on the actions going on in this picture. So that's what's going on with the Golden Key, and so you guys are the first to hear about it, and I'm really excited about it. So let's talk a little bit more. Courage is not a self-generated virtue. It is always produced by faith, whether in ourselves or God or something else. Mason tells us that it is within us already as image bearers. It is the virtue that underpins all the other virtues. Courage is the thing that allows us to make sacrifices and be dangerously unselfish, as Martin Luther King Jr. said in regard to our Christian faith. It helps us through pain, suffering, isolation, and other difficulties. The Bible commands us to be bold and courageous more than 25 times, and there are many more verses about when it is lacking and the sin and problems that then occur. So I love this quote by C.S. Lewis. Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, right? So do you have the courage to love when the person is unlovable? It's not really courage to love someone who's really easy to love, right? Can you forgive when you've been deeply wronged? Can you guide your family when they don't want your guidance? Can you keep on homeschooling and put your own dreams on hold? Can you be kind when someone has been unkind? Trust when you can't see God? That's courage, isn't it? As C.S. Lewis says, it's the form of every virtue at the testing point. So I'd like to read to you a passage from The Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. And if all you've done is seen the movie, you will not have seen this part, because they didn't make this part in it. So what we have going on here, this is the chapter of The Dark Island. And in this chapter, Lucy, Edmund, Eustace, and Caspian are sailing toward what they believe is an island, right? But as they approach, they find it is nothing but darkness. Lewis challenges the reader to imagine what it would have been like to sail up to the darkness. It tells the reader to picture a railroad tunnel so long or so twisty that you cannot see a light shining at the end. And when they realize that the island was where their worst nightmares will become flesh and blood, King Caspian has the ship turned around, and the men rush to sail out of the darkness, but to no avail. They begin to slip into their despair. And that's where I'm going to begin reading. Drinian's hand shook on the tiller, and a line of cold sweat ran down his face. The same idea was occurring to everyone on board. "We shall never get out. Never get out," moaned the rowers. "He's steering us wrong. We're going round and round in circles. We shall never get out." The stranger, who had been lying in a huddled heap on the deck, sat up and burst out into a horrible, screaming laugh. "Never get out," he yelled. "That's it, of course. We shall never get out. What a fool I was to have thought they would let me go as easily as that. No, no, we shall never get out." Lucy leaned her head on the edge of the fighting top and whispered, "Aslan, Aslan. If ever you loved us at all, send us help now." The darkness did not grow any less, but she began to feel a little, a very, very little better. "After all, nothing has really happened to us yet," she thought. "Look," cried Reinulf's voice hoarsely from the bows. There was a tiny speck of light ahead, and while they watched, a broad beam of light fell from it upon the ship. It did not alter the surrounding darkness, but the whole ship was lit up as if by searchlight. Caspian blinked, stared round, saw the faces of his companions all with wild, fixed expressions. Everyone was staring in the same direction. Behind everyone lay his black, sharply edged shadow. Lucy looked along the beam and presently saw something in it. At first, it looked like a cross, then it looked like an aeroplane, then it looked like a kite, and at last, with a whirring of wings, it was right overhead and was an albatross. It circled three times round the mast and then perched for an instant on the crest of the gilded dragon at the prow. It called out in a strong, sweet voice what seemed to be words, though no one understood them. After that, it spread its wings, rose, and began to fly slowly ahead, bearing a little to starboard. Drinian steered after it, not doubting that it offered good guidance. But no one except Lucy knew that as it circled the mast, it had whispered to her, "Courage, dear heart." And the voice, she felt sure, was Aslan's. And with the voice, a delicious smell breathed in her face. In a few moments, the darkness turned into a grayness ahead, and then almost before they dared to begin hoping, they had shot out into the sunlight and were in the warm, blue world again. And all at once, everybody realized that there was nothing to be afraid of and never had been. Have you ever been in one of those dark places? I sure have. Are you tired? Is your life full of uncertainty? We need to have the courage to trust God, even when we can't see Him. Like Lucy. God sees you. He hurts with you and will be there for you wherever your journey goes. Courage is just as important for the big dragon-slaying moments as it is for the mundane getting out of bed each morning. And everything in between. I would venture to guess that each of you has a story to tell as it relates to courage. And we should, I think, when we can, share them with one another for the specific reason of glorifying God. Charlotte Mason says that we need confidence and courage to parent. She's right, of course. So as we retreat here together and learn more about parent craft and think more about courage, let's remember 2 Timothy 1:17. For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control. Or Psalm 31:24, be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. And as we go this evening, I want to leave you with some inspiring words from Oswald Chambers. He says, it is a great thing to see physical courage, and greater still to see moral courage. But the greatest to see of all is spiritual courage. Oh, to see a person who will stand true to the integrity of Jesus Christ, no matter what he or she goes through. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.